accession number 18776, Reel 6.
Colonel Stuckey, Reel 6.
Well, the plan I evolved was a very simple and straightforward one, and that was that we would do a frontal attack with two platoons up, one platoon back with platoon headquarters, company headquarters, shall I say, with the rear platoon, and in a kind of V formation, supported by medium machine guns and Vickers and the mortars from our sister column on the right flank, and by our own medium machine guns and mortars on the left flank. And the reason I chose a frontal attack was that we had a wonderful cover from this Lalang, which is secondary growth, really. And I thought that that would be perhaps a simple and straightforward way of doing it than any other. And the plan was really a very simple one. It was that at HR, we would cross the start line in a traditional way. And I had reckoned that with something like 20 minutes, we would be perhaps two-thirds of the way towards the objective, Hill 60. And the plan was that after 20 minutes, the covering fire should open up. So the mortars and the medium machine guns at 10:20 were destined to come into action. Well, in what happened was that I had, as it were, misjudged the nature of the terrain, if you like, and it proved to be much thicker, more dense, more difficult. This Lalang Lantana, secondary growth, call it what you will, was much more difficult to get through than we had anticipated. So that after 20 minutes, instead of being somewhere near the objective, just ripe for the supporting fire to home us in onto the objective with a final charge, nothing of the sort occurred. In fact, we'd only got about a third at the most of the way to our objective when the covering fire opened up as planned on time. They couldn't see us anyway, we couldn't see them. They didn't know where we were, they were merely carrying out their orders. So they opened up. Well, we only had, I think we were only allowed to fire about two or three belts of 500 from the medium machine guns each. That was pretty limited, you might say. The mortars, I think we again were short of ammunition, short of mortar bombs. The number of bombs fired were, I think, nothing much, but perhaps something like six per mortar, which would be about 24 altogether. So anyhow, these were duly loosed off onto the target, and of course by at that stage we were nowhere near the objective. So the thing was in fact abortive in that sense, but also it was counterproductive in the sense that it alerted the enemy, who were probably having a good sleep up to then, to the fact that something was going on. Why should the enemy suddenly started throwing something at us, they must have been saying to themselves. However, nothing happened, and we continued to cut and slash and push our way through this horrible secondary growth, doing the best we could. And I suppose it was something like probably 45 minutes, 50 minutes before we got anywhere near the objective. And then the Japanese, who by this time, of course, were on the qui vive and were thoroughly alerted, were suddenly began to see movement in the growth down below. And then the fireworks began, and we found ourselves raked with fire from both flanks, cutting across our front, and the whole thing got really very nasty. I was in the rear, in the middle, and then my two other platoons, who were out of sight, I may say, couldn't see anything that was going on. So I eventually kept going, and so ultimately we're in a position where I was up, three platoons were more or less in line up front, all within about probably 100, 150 yards at the most of the objective. And we were being strafed and raked with fire from both sides, and things were getting pretty nasty. And I had a report from, first of all, the right flank came in. A runner came over, African, to say that Baturi Matthews, Yamutu, meaning Sergeant Matthews, had been killed. Now, he was a splendid Welshman, very staunch and a good chap, and so I was. That was a very sad event. Then I had another report coming in from. I had a lieutenant left called Percy Buckle. Only about six or eight Europeans left out of about 35, 40 in the column. By this time, I should add, we were very much, as it were, cut down in numbers because of people who'd been wounded, killed, evacuated, or whatever, with sickness. So there weren't many Europeans, but I had my left hand. I only had two Europeans in the company. One was Sergeant Matthews, commanding the platoon on the right, and then the one in the middle, where I was commanded by an African. One on the left was commanded by a chap called Percy Buckle. Now, sorry, I got it wrong. Percy Buckle was the first to send a messenger over to me saying, I'm sorry, I can't go any further because every time I try to move, we're being strafed, we're being raked with fire. And then, so I was just wondering what, how to play it. And then I got a message from the other flank, which was Sergeant Matthews. His runner came over and said, you know, we've lost our white man. Our Baturi has been killed outright. And so I thought, oh dear. So it meant the African sergeant would be in charge, who would be quite capable, I may say, but never mind. And so I was really wondering what to do next. And I had no supporting fire. The Japanese seemed to have the whip hand. And I was sort of debating in my mind, do we try and do a sort of heroic dash for the objective, throwing all caution to the winds? And I thought, well, this would be suicidal, frankly, and very irresponsible, because here you've got a bunch of soldiers who have been in the field for 5 months nearly. They're, as it were, suffering terribly from debilitation, from lack of food and so on. They're generally in a very poor state physically. They've lasted this long, and to throw them now onto something which was suicidal would be, to put it mildly, irresponsible and not the thing to do at all. Anyhow, I was turning all this over in my mind, thinking, where does my duty lie? What should I be doing? And then I got a message. A chap came up from behind, African, saying that a message from Baba and Baturi, a message from the CO, which says that the other column, 66 column, have managed to put some people on. They've come on the other flank. They managed to get on top from the other flank. Well, I didn't know that 66 column were even involved, so I was pretty in the dark. Anyway, my instructions were to stay where I was. So I sighed a bit of a sigh of relief. And, of course, the other thing I should remember, I suppose, and that is that another very sad thing. I had, while all this was going through my mind, and we were wondering what to do next, and we were wondering, really, had the Japanese withdrawn? Because there was total silence. The firing and shooting had stopped. Nothing was happening. And then my African company sergeant major, who was a very experienced and quite a sensible chap, who was just kneeling in front of me, stood up just to have a look. I suppose something came over him which said, I'll have a look and see if what's going on and see if the Japanese are still there. And almost instantly, I saw his brains coming out from the back of his head, literally. The bullet, somebody got up, there must have been someone, obviously they had snipers or marksmen just waiting for a target. This chap got up and the bullet went straight in here. His brains came out there, and everything happened right in front of me.
He was shot through the forehead.
Yes, he was shot through the forehead. And it was a very sort of sad event, really, and disconcerting. And I thought, well, I've always reproved myself in a sense that I thought, well, if only I'd grabbed him. I was so shocked and dazed and amazed at what I saw. I couldn't believe that anyone would be standing up having a look. It was such a damn silly thing to do. But it's in human nature, they say, don't they, that sometimes you are you're contrarian. You do something which is totally contrary to common sense or to judgment or to experience, just for the hell of it, if you like. And I can only think that something like this came over him, and he said, well, I'm damn well going to stand up and have a look. I can't stand kneeling here any longer. And he got up, and that was the last thing he did. But I also think, well, if only I'd been reacted a bit quicker and just grabbed him, which I could have done. He said, get down, you fool. I might have saved his life, but I was a bit slow. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. Anyhow, that's one of the sort of many sadnesses one has, to see somebody like that, who was a good man, shot down unnecessarily. So that was the third thing. I had Sergeant Matthews killed on the right. Percy Buckle said he couldn't make any progress on the left. My African Sergeant Major being killed in front of my eyes. And so it was all a bit gloomy. And then, to my intense relief, I was trying to work out what my duty was. My intense relief, I was told that they'd got onto the hill from the flank and I could stick where I was, which I duly did. Anyhow, the subsequent story was that we stayed there. And then we were told to pull back a bit and sort of hold the front line, as it were, which we duly did, thankfully. And then, of course, the full story emerged, and that was that the Japanese had indeed withdrawn from Hill 60, which was quite a common ploy of theirs. They would withdraw, and then they would regroup, and then they would stage a counterattack. And that's exactly what they did. And although a platoon of 66 column had actually got onto the sort of part of the feature, if you like, they were very soon smartly driven off it by a Japanese force that came in some strength, and they had to beat a very hasty retreat indeed. So by the end of that day, the story was it's so near and yet so far. We thought we'd probably succeeded in getting on. We hadn't actually physically. My own company hadn't got on the hill. But I was rather pleased that somebody else had, partly because of our contribution. But in fact, it wasn't the case at all. The Japanese, the counterattack, got back, taking possession of the hill, and that was that. So we were back in square one. Well, we dug in that night. There was a certain amount of shelling went on all the time. We were all the time, as it were, subject to that. But the next day, there was a day of, I think, planning, and I think the CO had decided, the Brigadier, rather, Abdi Ricketts, had decided that this is too big a job for one column, so we'd bring in our sister column, number 43, number 12, I mean, we were 43, our sister column, number 12, would come in, and we would do a sort of two-column attack, a battalion attack, with our sister battalion, that's right, sister battalion, six and I, one of their columns was to come in too. So we were to mount a much bigger effort. Not the next day, but the day after. The next day, in fact, was a day of tragedy, an important and telling day, in that when we were licking our wounds and making plans for the big attack the next day, in which we were a supporting role, I should mention perhaps at this stage that we had met up with the Chinese American infantry. And they had come across down the corridor, and they were American officer led, but Chinese manned, and they were artillery, and they had artillery and mortars, and their job was to provide covering fire and to help our supporting fire. They were new, and They had a very good colonel with them called Dupuy, who we met up with, and he was very helpful. But there were some sad consequences in that the very next day, when our sister column commander, Skip Taylor, Major Skip Taylor, was having a little O group about the next day's operations, we had the supporting fire from the Chinese American. One of their shells landed short. And of course it had to land almost in the middle of the O group that Major Skip Taylor was holding. And the consequence of that was that one of our captains, Captain John Heap, was killed outright. A lieutenant called Briggs, Basil Briggs, he was killed outright. An African orderly was killed outright. Major Skip Taylor himself had a bad arm injury, had to be evacuated. So we lost three and one or two at least wounded because of an undershoot of a ranging shell, unnecessary. And of course that caused a certain amount of consternation because it meant that our sister column didn't have a commander anymore. So the company commander, a chap called Miles, Tom Miles, he had to take over, do the best he could. However, that being said, that was just one of the sort of minor things one had to put up with. And the plan went on. And the next day, the attack as planned went in. We were in a supporting role, fighting a supporting fire, and our sister column, and a column of 66, I think it was, of 66 column, also attacked. But they got nowhere, I'm afraid. They were seen off by the Japanese, a few more casualties. So by the end of day three, we concluded that with two attacks, we had still not achieved our objective. And we'd had lost quite a few people into the bargain. There were some people killed on the other flank too, one or two from the other column, 12 and 12 column. One, in fact, very good chap, a sergeant, British sergeant, who was killed, who was actually going out trying to rescue an African who was injured, and he went out to bring him in, and he got shot by a sniper himself, and he was killed outright, just like that. But the ultimate outcome was that it was decided that because we were at the end of our tether, we'd been in 5 months, we were only supposed to be in for three, the story in the background you'll be probably well aware of, and that is that we were, owing to Wingate's death, premature, command had been passed to Vinegar Joe, General Joe Stilwell, which is a very unfortunate decision because he had something of an antipathy towards the British troops, and he didn't like the Limeys, and he made no bones about saying so. And he determined that instead of letting us out after 3 months, which was Wingate's plan, because he said, if you've done 3 months in the jungle on these under these conditions, then you're not really fit to go on any longer. But because he had lost his life in the air crash, and because we were under command of Vinegar Joe Stilwell, he said, well, if my lot, Merrill's Marauders, called a guerrilla force, if my lot can stay in, so can you Limeys. So we, in fact, found ourselves in for 5 months instead of 3 months. And so we were in a pretty poor state. We'd lost an awful lot of people, both white officers and NCOs, a lot of Africans. We were debilitated. We were all thoroughly underweight, undernourished, and I won't say demoralized, because I think spirits held out remarkably well, considering the conditions. I think people were immune to being immoralized. They were just taking it, really, saturated, and took it as it came. But the good news came that we were not to do any more attacks. We were to patrol madly, which we did, with quite a lot of success, actually. We were never allowed to sit still for one moment. We were patrolling here, standing patrols here, recce patrols there. We were dominating. We had a very active brigadier, you see, Abdi Ricketts, who was a very front man, liked to be up front, leading everything. Sometimes he ought not to have been. He'd been better off if he hadn't been up front, but still, he was a bit of a daredevil, but in some ways, many ways, he was a very courageous chap, if sometimes misguided. But his idea was, quite rightly, to dominate the scene. It means you can't progress, you can patrol. You have people outstanding patrol here, reconnaissance patrol there. All the time you're keeping the enemy guessing as to what you're up to and stopping the enemy from patrolling towards you, so to speak. And of course, if you're doing that kind of thing, it's much better for morale, because if you just sit waiting to be shot at and do nothing, it's nothing more demoralizing. But if you send a patrol out and it does something, at least it gives them the feeling that they have achieved something, and they come back and give you some information. So you are, to some extent, taking an initiative. And that has to be good for morale, if nothing else. However, that went on. And then, of course, the story became apparent, and that was that the great 36th British Division was moving in, down, going to take over from us, and move down the railway corridor. And we were told that we were to cooperate fully with them, and we did that, and we had to show them round. I remember taking General, the divisional commander, a chap called Frankie Festing, who ultimately became Chief of General Staff, but he came up and I took him round the front line and showed him what I could, showed him where the Japanese were and what the layout of Hill 60 was and where we believed their strengths were and so on, the best approaches. And so he was very good, very grateful for all that. And then the decision came that something like 8 or 10 days later, by which time all hell had been knocked out of Hill 60 by our own medium bombers, the Mitchells, and our own Mustangs. And the thing really was looking out of Hill 60 in the First World War. By then, there was hardly a tree left on it. It was bare, but there was really it was really subject to a most enormous strafing and bombardment daily. Plus, don't forget the efforts of the Chinese American infantry, who, when they were on target, were quite good. So it had a really good softening up, which we never had the benefit of, unfortunately. But and the decision came that the Royal Sussex Battalion were to put in the attack on Hill 60, and that happened. Royal Sussex moved through our front line, went to the attack, and they succeeded in a day in getting onto the hill. And they moved on through, and we followed up behind, and we sat on Hill 60, and they moved on ahead. Then they consolidated, and I don't know whether it's for your records or not, but subsequently the plan was that the South Wales Borderers should continue the advance, jumping through the Royal Sussex and going on beyond Hill 60 to the south, down towards Samoa, which was our next objective, a rather key point on the road to Mogong, Samoa. And the South Wales Borderers, I learned all about this later, and I had one of my friends from Sandhurst had been involved. But the South Wales Borderers had a very tough time in the sense that they decided to do their movement by night, and they moved through the Royal Sussex in the moonlight, and they came to a very wide open, well, it must have been paddy fields, I think, open spaces, could only have been paddy, and everything was fine, but they were rather bunched. And they were moving through across this open space at about 3 o'clock in the morning, in the moonlight, and all was quiet. And suddenly, a Japanese sentry, who had obviously been asleep, suddenly woke up and let out a great cry of warning, which alerted everybody. And from that moment onwards, there was really all hell let loose and considerable carnage. Because what happened was the South Wales Borderers were caught in the open, in the middle, by automatic fire from all flanks, and were pinned down, and they couldn't move. And eyewitness account told me afterwards, he said, well, these poor chaps, they were out there in the middle, and if they tried to move, even crawling, anything that moved got shot at. And they had suffered a considerable number of casualties, and I think there would have been total carnage, except for the fact that, again, Japanese, unpredictable as always, I think knocked hell out of the South Wales Borderers and then suddenly decided to decamp and pushed off and withdrew. So that enabled the South Wales Borderers to sort of collect themselves, to regroup, to lick their wounds, to get the casualties out. And then I think from that moment onwards, the advance was continued by, I don't know who the 3rd Battalion was of that brigade, but that was the end of story as far as we were concerned on Hill 60, except for the evacuation and the march out. And we then had to march, I think it was about 20 miles to Mogong, and that was quite a problem because it was pretty hot and we were carrying our packs and everything else. The packs we carried were, I haven't mentioned that, but we're always carrying considerable weight. It was a telling time getting there, but we did it. Some of us did it in one day, some of us did it in 2 days. But I always recollect, and I mentioned it in one of my accounts somewhere, that there was an African soldier who was quite near me. We were all just marching along. making for Mogal and hoping for the best, and this poor chap just suddenly collapsed and dropped down. The MO or somebody was not too far away, had a look at him. He said he's just dead, he just died of exhaustion. And I said, well, isn't that sad? Almost terrible tragedy for him, so near and yet so far again. Been through all this, and then within, you know, a matter of hours of Mogong, where he'd been in safety, he collapsed and died. So that I remember. Then we got to Mogong, where we were told to get on the railway to Michinar. And the railway, of course, there was no real, well, there was a railroad, but there were no engines or anything like that. There were a few trucks, and they were pulled by jeeps. And this is, again, a bit of American, I think, ingenuity. And what they'd done was taken the wheels off the jeeps and put rail wheels on the jeeps instead, and fixed the wheels so the front wheels didn't steer. They were all fixed. And so what they were doing is using the jeep as a little mini locomotive on the rail track to pull these four, half a dozen flats. Yes? And but of course the jeep hadn't got the guts to start the thing off. So what you had to do was run along beside, get the thing moving. And once it was in motion, you jumped on board, and then the jeep could keep going. It was all very Heath Robinson. But it worked, and it took us, 15 or so miles up to Michinar, 15, 20 miles, I guess, to Michinar, where there was an airfield. And so we reached that very thankfully, eventually. And then we got into aircraft, and we went back to Lalagat, I think it was. And that was back home again, you might say, or back into Indian territory proper. And that, apart from a few medical problems we had, that was the end of story. So we counted our losses and we counted our blessings, and we came to the conclusion that those who got through were lucky people. And there were no very immediate serious repercussions, I don't think, except that several of us had problems in the digestive type problems, and I had jaundice. A lot of us had jaundice, and we had to go into hospital for a couple of weeks, I think it was, with jaundice.
What mental condition were you in by the time you got out?
Mental? Well, I don't think that it was noticeable that we were either exuberant or demoralized or anything. I think it was just a question of this is one's lot, and you got on with it. And we weren't aware that we were demoralized or depressed. I think we were very exhilarated in the sense that at least we've got away with it. We've come away. We left a lot of unfortunate chaps behind, unfortunately, very sad about that. But we were exhilarated by the fact that at least we've come through and got back safely. I don't know whether we had any great sense of achievement or whatever, but we really weren't thinking that much about it, I suppose, at the time. But it's amazing, really, because I was only, 23, I suppose, in 1944, 23, yes, I hadn't yet reached my 24th birthday. I mean, I was young and fit and active, so in my mind it wasn't too difficult. But what was amazing was how some of the older people performed. There was one chap, for instance, who insisted on getting in, Roger Curry, who was, I think, 42 or something like that. It was 40 anyway, 40, 42. Roger's Devonshire Regiment, regular soldier, major. But he's one of your, what you might call, stiff upper lip types. But Roger was a lovely man, a real gent, a very gentle man. But he was